In the studio this morning, I have Glenn Holland, a director of the Auckland Zoo. Glenn grew up in South Africa with a background in nature conservation and captive management, where he focused on ornithology and aviculture, which is bird keeping. And Glenn's here to share his experience, so good morning, Glenn.
Morning to you, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Yes, well, you've come all the way from Africa, the great ark or sanctuary of animals, to New Zealand. And, of course, really, we don't have the great megafauna that you have in Africa.
Tell me you don't, but one of the exciting things about being in New Zealand is that there are so many threats to so many of your species. In Africa, the majority of species, particularly the large ungulates, are actually pretty safe. Elephants, for example, at the moment in Kruger National Park, they have an excess of 3,500, and they don't know what to do with them. In New Zealand, most of your species, with 50% already lost, most of the rest of your species are actually under a lot of threat. So the work that needs to be done to save those is really exciting. There's a lot of groundbreaking work that has been done and is still being done in New Zealand, and it's nice to be a part of that.
Well, with your TV program, I think it's on Sunday nights, it really captures your imagination because it's real. And I've heard so many people say, oh, look, I just want to watch that because it brings out the emotions. There's plenty of touch. You see how these animals get moved from a precarious situation into a safe environment. So how is the program coming along in Auckland Zoo?
We absolutely thrilled, Tim, because zoos, particularly by people who aren't associated with zoos or perhaps don't visit them regularly, can still be regarded as places of caged animals. And zoos have moved so far, particularly in the last probably 15 years, so far forward in terms of real conservation achievements. And the TV program just gives us an opportunity to let the man in the street see some of those. It'll never do enough. There's a lot more we'd like to be telling people about, but it most certainly carries really strong messages. And I think, you know, love for nature is not intrinsic. People aren't born with it. It's something you learn, and it grows with you. And I think that program really gives us a good opportunity to make that appreciation and love for nature just that much stronger in the public.
You mentioned that you can have sleepovers for children to stay at the zoo.
Tim, we started about 1.5 years ago now with the old elephant house. We converted it into a function center and a nighttime sleepover for kids. And it's really taken off. It took about 6 to 8 months for people to become aware of it, a lot of word of mouth, and, of course, people hearing other people's experience. We do groups of roughly 30 children with a few adults, and we have a staff member sleeping close by just in case of any emergencies. And the kids come in. They obviously all excited because kids love walking around at night with torches. We give them a couple of torches with a cellophane covering so they don't blind animals. And they're able to go around the zoo with a keeper and hear stories about the species, see them at night. And a lot of the species, for example, lions are particularly active at night, whereas during the day they tend to spend most of the day sleeping, which people still find difficult to accept. But it's a fact that even in the wild, lions sleep most of the day. So at night the kids are able to actually go right up to the lions where the glass viewing is. The lions are very active. They'll stalk the kids. They'll jump towards the glass as if they're hunting the kids. And, of course, creates a lot of excitement. So it's a whole new experience, and they have the whole zoo to themselves. And it's really going well, and we're starting to do evening barbecues for more corporate groups now as well with the same sort of experience, not the sleepovers for adults. But it's going really well, and it's proving popular.
Well, when they wake up, children wake up in the morning, is there a lion roar? Do the birds wake up first? How is it?
The zoo's a pretty noisy place, 24 hours really, particularly at night. And very often the old elephant house where they sleep is right next to the rainforest. And we have 4 Siamang gibbons who very early in the morning proclaim their territory to neighbouring groups, which of course aren't out there, but they don't know that. So every morning they'll actually proclaim their territory. And they do that by blowing into a large pouch on the throat and then making this incredibly loud sound call that you can hear all around the Western Springs area. And I would imagine, I haven't slept over with the kids, but I would imagine that would be the first thing that wakes them up every morning.
And you've got the giraffe and the big ones, the rhino and the hippos. Do the children hear their sounds as well, or are they more quieter?
Lions, particularly. Lions roar pretty well right through the night, again early morning as well, proclaiming territory. And the tiger niche is a female, and if she's in season, which is for about 4 days every month or so, she'll actually do a call, a very loud call as well, that she just does all night to attract a mate. And I might just add in here, if I could, that niche is part of an international breeding program for endangered species. She's the Sumatran tiger. There are only about 250 to 300 left. And she's a very important animal, but genetically she has a number of brothers and sisters, so she's not that important for breeding, but she's important in terms of just a number. We've been looking for a rather unique bloodline to breed with Nisha, who's now heading towards 8 years old. So she's got about another 6 to 8 years of productive life. And we've just very recently had a call from Israel to say, we have a young male which we can offer you, and the stud bookkeeper who manages the genetics worldwide of that population has said that it'll be an excellent match. So finally, we've been telling the public for years how Nisha's part of a breeding program, and finally next year we'll be getting a male tiger Sumatran as well, and be pairing the two up probably about June next year.
It's interesting, because if you had a Bengal tiger and a Sumatran tiger, there'd be no problems with mating them?
No, they'd mate, and you can even cross a lion and a tiger. It's very much frowned upon, though, in the zoo world, and ethically would be incorrect, and from a conservation point of view, just a waste of time.
Yes.
And in actual fact, breeding Bengal tigers is almost a waste, because they aren't as endangered. All tigers are threatened, and numbers are declining, but rather use the space you have available. You can only hold so many tigers in, say, the Australasian region. Rather let us use that space for Sumatran tigers than fill it with Bengal tigers, which are, to be honest, a dime a dozen, particularly in the US.
I see, because if you've got the tigers in northern China, up in the Siberia, now they've evolved without knowing that each other has evolved.
That's
and
right.
Yet they can still mate together.
Oh, absolutely. They're the same genus, just subspecies. So there's five or six subspecies of tiger, and they will all mate together. And as I say, you can even cross a lion and a tiger successfully. The offspring are infertile of that cross, but you can do it.
Uh-huh. With the Auckland's projects, the zoo projects, now you get different animals from various places in the world. Can you tell us about how you're bringing them in?
Sure. We've got basically three groupings of animals, if I can put it that way. We've got our endangered species programs, which are international programs, like Sumatran tiger. We've got red panda, a number of other species, particularly the primates as well. We've got Bornean orangutans, which are all part of an international program. So we work internationally. We try and work through this region with Australasia, primarily swapping animals either in New Zealand or with Australia. But every now and then, in terms of genetics, we have to go outside of that. And that's why it's just such good news to have this tiger coming in from Israel. It's totally unrelated to any others in the region. Then we have our native fauna, which are our jewels, really, to be honest. We've got 11 species breeding programs now, which we work very closely with DOC. The most recent, and really we were thrilled to be a part of, is the little native Archie's frog. And not many people know, but New Zealand has four native species of frog. They really are unique. Most species, for example, of frogs have done their whole life cycle in 2 to 5 years. This little frog, the Archie's, only starts breeding at 5 years of age. They live to at least 35 years and counting, so we're not quite sure how far past that they'll go. But we know they live at least 35 years of age. The male broods a little group of about 12 eggs on lichen and moss, a moist area. The froglets hatch onto his back, climb on to dad for about 2 weeks, and then about 2 weeks later they go off and live a life on their own. So we really are unique. And the issue with these frogs, for example, is chytrid fungus. It's a fungal disease that gets into the feeds on the skin, basically, is wiping out frogs in particularly the southern hemisphere. Australia, when I last heard, were losing about 2 species of frogs per year. And the Archie's frog used to be able to go out during the day and count roughly 30 frogs in a day, doing some square counts in certain areas, which every year they went back to do those counts. and then suddenly notice that the numbers are dropping off, and now you're lucky if you find one. So we've got 54 Archie's frogs in a specially designed refrigerated unit now. It is available for public to view, but unfortunately these frogs don't like to show themselves, so you can view the project, but you don't often see the frog itself. But it's probably the most threatened species that we've got at the moment, and it's just another nice example. But that with the kiwi that we do, Operation Nest Egg, between 20 and 25 eggs come in a year. We breed tuatara, and we've just hatched a group of tuatara that will be released back onto island sanctuaries. We do eggs from fairy tern, which there are only 8 pairs left in New Zealand. So if there's a nest under threat from high tides or whatever it might be, we may caretake those eggs or even put them under another pair of birds, but they'll go through the zoo. We'll look after them until Doc are ready to place those eggs, and then we'll put those eggs back with other parents. Last year, three of the 5 birds that fledged had actually been through the zoo as an egg form and then back out to the wild. And we have another number of other breeding programs with native species. And then we also have a group of animals that, to be honest, are there primarily for education and for recreation, because it's important people have an enjoyable day. People want to see a lot of primates. People love the primate family. And not all of the species we've got are particularly endangered. Some of them are, some of them aren't. For us, we're quite happy to have a number of species that aren't endangered, because it's all about showing global biodiversity. So, for example, we have a pair of yellow and blue macaws, and we free fly those birds over the public. They all sit on the lawn, and we free fly the birds during summer. Now, yes, macaws are threatened in the wild, but to be honest, what we're doing has got nothing to do with a breed and release program for an endangered species. It's simply using macaws as advocate for the rainforest, and also to give people a really enjoyable experience. Because, as I said, you know, love for nature is not intrinsic. It needs to be embedded in people. And close encounters where the macaw, for example, flies over the kids' heads, may even tip their head occasionally with the end of the wing, is an unforgettable experience, and that's what it's all about as well.
Yes, a big program. Can I swing back to the Archie's frog?
Sure.
Now, how would you keep them alive, put them back into nature again, if this fungi or this...
We don't know, to be honest. Not enough's known about the frog itself. Not enough is known about the fungus. So there may well be something that we can develop in terms of an antibody, etc., to that. We don't even know where the disease itself, the fungus, is coming from and how it's travelling around the world. So there's so much to be learnt about it. We've got no plans at the moment to actually release any back. So it's a safe population, and we'll be breeding as many as we can and working on the research, what temperatures, how much water, how much moisture, etc., what food in terms of the diet, what will stimulate those frogs to breed. So there's a lot of work to be done just to learn about how to actually breed them. At the same time, our vets are working with other vets in New Zealand and have recently hosted a workshop of New Zealand experts on frog diseases. So we're working on the disease issue, we're working on the actual breeding of the frog, and at the same time maintaining a safe population. So reintroduction could be a long way off, and until we know more about the species and the disease itself, it won't be on the horizon, to be honest.
Because frogs usually come from tadpoles too, and so this is a new one for us or from New Zealand to have, you call them froglets.
That's right. Well, it's interesting because usually the frog egg will hatch and you'll have a tadpole stage for quite a long time, and then slowly it metamorphosizes into the frog stage itself. With these Archie's frogs, the tadpole actually develops in the egg. So if you look into the egg, you can see very clearly the tadpole actually living and growing inside this membrane. When they hatch, they are actually froglets, so they have legs and they're able to crawl onto dad's back.
And so dad's doing the work, huh?
Oh, the usual.
Yes. With the fact that the conservation now has come in, you're working with Doc, whereas once upon a time, did you have the same arrangement, or is this a sort of like a commercial way of being able to get the public involved, to self-finance yourself, and also to have a cooperative arrangement with Doc?
To be honest, I think we should talk about the zoo as a business, because it is a business, and it's an interesting one, because it's a big combination of heart and mind, not just heart and not just mind, but it's an interesting combination. But in terms of conservation, I think it's more we are driven, our management team are driven, and our team leaders are driven to achieve real conservation outcomes. And we could very easily slip into a very comfortable situation where we basically only look at what happens within our walls, and that's what zoos historically have done. It would be an absolute waste, and to be honest, I wouldn't sleep well at night if we were doing that, because we're a resource. We develop a lot of technical expertise. Both the vets and the keepers know a tremendous amount about the species they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. We've got all of that expertise, and we've got the species themselves. And if we don't utilize those species for real conservation, which is field conservation, not just about captive, it would be an absolute waste. So we are forming very strong links now with the wild. For example, our orangutans, we've got a Sumatran orangutan program that we're supporting. We're supporting a turtle program in Vietnam, which has 20,000 school children involved and is really going ahead in leaps and bounds. We are linking to a cheetah outreach program in Southern Africa. We're involved in Ark in the Park, just on our doorstep, and recently been involved in reintroducing species, and we do some of the trapping and eradication of pests. So it's really a lot of outreach work, and we're building a brand new veterinary center now as well, and 50% of that will focus on the zoo animals. The other 50% will be focused on New Zealand species nationwide. And if I can give an example, there's an introduced Australian mosquito that carries avian malaria. We discovered avian malaria in dotterels here in Auckland, and did quite a lot of research on how prevalent it was and write-ups on it, and next minute it popped up at Tikuiti. So the mosquito carries it, and the mosquito had moved that far. Well, this was only, you know, a year or two ago we were saying it's now got to Aotearoa Tikuiti area. It's now past Dunedin, and it's killing yellowheads down in the South Island. So it gives you an idea of the threats to our wildlife. I think wildlife disease, and we term it conservation medicine, is a whole new field that really needs a lot more exploration. Avian flu, everybody's well aware of it. It's just one example. There's many examples of such diseases that are affecting man, the environment, and the wildlife as well. And that triangle are very closely related, all 3 points. And conservation medicine is quite a new discipline, and again, I wouldn't say we're world leaders, but we're most certainly up there in terms of the research that's being done. The concern, I guess, is we've only looked at the tip of the iceberg, and what's come out is frightening us. We've looked at some kiwi blood samples, for example, and Babesia is a new blood parasite for New Zealand, didn't even know it existed here, and that's just having one look. So we need to do a lot more research on what diseases are affecting our wildlife. Because particularly when you've got small populations, like black stilt, 150 or so birds, you get a disease in there, you could lose most of your population almost overnight. So it's a very real threat, and definitely it's a lot more work. So this new centre we're building, our charitable trust actually raising the funds for that, is focused, you know, 50% of the work will be national work, looking at wildlife disease. And I might just mention, finish on that point, is our vets have just joined Doc very recently and taken the second lot of 50 Campbell Island teal, which was the world's rarest duck, 20-year breeding program before success. Doc did the largest rat eradication ever done on Campbell Island, 14,000 hectares it was, and have now reintroduced the Campbell Island teal back to its original habitat, which is just a phenomenal program. It's, as I say, taken 20 years to go full circle. Of course, Campbell Island teal being back on the island is fantastic, but the benefits to seabirds on Campbell Island without rats is phenomenal as well. So a great project, and our vets have been down there with the birds, checking those birds were healthy, that we didn't take diseases down. And then while they were down there, they took a lot of samples off albatross, chicks, etc., penguins, down there to find out what diseases were already on Campbell Island. So it's a whole new field, and quite exciting.
We're very lucky here, of course, in New Zealand, having all these offshore islands, so that they're little arcs, and you can even focus certain species on a certain island, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yes. Have We looked at the idea of, I guess, taking just DNA from some of these animals that are right on the edge of extinction for cloning. It sounds terrible, but...
I don't know. It sounds terrible. We haven't investigated it. We haven't been part of it. But yes. Most certainly with Kakapo, for example, they are storing semen samples because AI is a very real possibility with animals being done internationally. With endangered cranes, we're looking at doing it with elephants. We've tried it with giraffe. AI is a very real possibility for the future. So it's all about genetics, and if you go through a bottleneck too often, which is basically deleted or depleted genetic pool, you know, your species can run into trouble. So if we can keep samples, be it ova of certain species or semen samples, for example, frozen for the years to come, I think it's a very good thing. In terms of DNA work and cloning, can't comment really. I've heard the odd discussion about it, but I don't think anything's actually happening on it right now.
Can you just tell us a little bit how your public relations runs?
Sure. We have a marketing and public relations department because, as I said, the zoo's very much a business. We don't receive a lot of handouts. We have to make ends meet. We're close to 80% self-funding, and zoos internationally tend to look at about 50% self-funding. So we have a very active PR machine, and it's really two people who make all of that happen. And we get a lot of good uptake because the stories are generally very interesting, and people like those unusual animal stories. But it really is important that we do get the right messages out as well. And with the website, for example, it's about to be completely overhauled. It is good, but it can be better. I don't know the figure off the top of my head, but we do get a tremendous number of hits in the hundreds of thousands every month on the website, and then actual visits is pretty high as well. Yes, kids definitely do use it, and we've got a fair amount of information on the website, but most of the children come through the zoo as school parties, organized parties, and we do about 60,000 school children a year. We've got a brand new education facility with three purposeful classrooms, and of the 60,000 kids, roughly 30,000 have a face-to-face experience, so they actually sit down with a teacher for 40 minutes or so, and the teacher will talk them through an aspect in their curriculum of conservation related to the zoo, and they can then go out and explore themselves. The other 30,000 receive a pack, which again relates to the curriculum of activities, and they'll go into the zoo and they'll actually run the pack through the pack themselves with their teachers. One of the most exciting recent events is a program called Poo at the Zoo and You. And it sounds a bit terrible, but it's been extremely popular. And that program is all about recycling. So we recycle pretty well all of the animal waste now, and that's produced into compost that you can actually purchase called Zoodoo. But along with that as well, we take the kids through the rest of the recycling of plastic, tins, all that sort of thing. We recycle now about 65% of what used to go to the tip. And we've also cut, we were the biggest user of water in the whole of Auckland City, I was rather shocked to hear that recently. And we've cut that by 40% and power by 35%. So we've got a teacher now who talks to the kids about water, power, wastage, and of course all of the recycling as well. And that's becoming really popular. And I think in terms of what the person in the city can best do for conservation, it is really to be thinking and practicing sustainability. So recycling, don't waste water, cutting down on power consumption rather than having all the light bulbs burning. And we're fortunate to have a chap in the zoo, an asset manager, who's very keen on that and watches every tap that gets opened, even monitors on the computer. He can tell you overnight if somebody's left a hose pipe running in the zoo. So he watches it like a hawk, and he'll report pretty well daily to say something's happened in that particular area of the zoo. Somebody's wasting water, or there's been a spike in power because a heater was left on. So we get watched every day, and it really is working well in terms of our business.
A little microcosm of something working extremely tightly. I think that's wonderful. And, of course, Western Springs, many people don't know that that's a great area for spring water to come up. And originally it was the water supply for early Auckland.
That's right.
And so you're having this lovely clear water.
Fantastic. Particularly this time of year, obviously the rainfall affects it, so the higher the rainfall, the more clear water that's produced. In summer it's not particularly good, but we have a siphon line from near to the actual spring, and it feeds part of the zoo, not the whole of the zoo, but some of the moats around the primates, etc., are fed by a siphon line. Our otter pool as well is fed by a siphon line, and then that goes back into the stream itself. And it's just fantastic to have such a big supply of water on our doorstep.
And, of course, animals know the difference between chlorinated water and fresh water. So this is fantastic for them to have it right at their doorstep.
It is. And another one is we had sea lions in the old sea lion pool, and they were primarily on mains water, and they used a lot of water, chlorinated water. And we had endless issues with eye problems because of the chlorine. But we needed the chlorine, obviously, to keep it, you know, sanitized. And having moved those sea lions now into the new exhibit where they actually have saline water, we've basically had no health issues since the day they were moved into the saline water. And the other thing is interesting, of course, in terms of natural behavior, an animal is quite heavy in fresh water, and the way any of us would swim, etc., is very different fresh to saline water. And when we put the sea lions into saline, they suddenly learn to use their buoyancy that they'd never used before, and they now are, you know, quite at home in it. But the first two or three days, they weren't quite sure what to do with the sudden buoyancy that they had. It was really interesting.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, I used to go and watch the polar bears, and of course, polar bears range over an area of possibly 200 or 300 square miles up in the Arctic. And you don't have them now, do you?
To be honest, we will never have bears again. It's a personal thing of mine, but polar bears don't need a breeding program in New Zealand, you know, in terms of saving the species. And bears are popular, but the issues involved with enrichment for their lives, and as you say, the space that they require, just keeping bears busy, you need a couple of people employed full-time to be challenging those bears all day, every day. And Auckland Zoo won't have bears again. Those bears, and I didn't see them, but I have heard, paced continually.
That's right.
And it's just unacceptable in a modern zoo to have an animal that paces. And it's there's too much involved with it, to be honest. I think ethically, and this is just a personal viewpoint, or an Auckland Zoo viewpoint, because we've all agreed not to have bears at Auckland Zoo again, the cons outweigh the pros in terms of having bears as a species in a zoo. There are some zoos that do them very well, but we don't have the resources that they do, and you would need to add probably 100,000 in terms of a staff wage bill alone just to be able to keep those bears really busy during the day. One of the things I might mention on that is that our staff, you know, in terms of dedication, you can probably see it on the TV program. We have no issues, and all of our staff are very professional. They're well trained and absolutely dedicated to what they do, and they spend a large portion of their day actually providing enrichment for the animals. So whether it be walking the elephants or taking the elephants up into the forest at the top of the zoo and letting them do what elephants do. Of course, the horticulturists don't like that. They do a fair bit of destruction. But,
yes.
But it's important that animals can exhibit those natural behaviours.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it isn't always a natural behaviour. Sometimes we do use artificial behaviours to stimulate and to keep animals busy. But you'll see, for example, with Serval, which is the little African spotted cat, you'll see Trent going in with a lure, almost like a fly rod, flicking a lure around and making the cat jump up to 3 meters to catch it, etc., which is all a natural behavior. And it's important to keep that in animals and keep them mentally and physically stimulated. So we spend a lot of our time working on that.
And with the zoo, Glenn, can it expand? Is there enough land there for you to move out?
To be honest, at the moment, it would be nice to have more land for example, hoofstock, if we wanted to have more rhino or a bigger springbok herd, etc. But what we do is we work very closely with Hamilton Zoo, and they have quite a lot of land. So, for example, with giraffe, if we produce male giraffe, Hamilton have agreed to keep excess males. So they've got a bachelor herd, and they've agreed not to breed. With white rhino, for example, we don't have a lot of space, so we've agreed to hold 2 male white rhino, and not be involved in the breeding program. We actually sent our cow down to Hamilton. So we do work a lot with other zoos in terms of sufficient space for hoof stock, but in New Zealand, we really could do at the moment with a large open plains type zoo, which could have larger herds of antelope and also maintain a bigger genetic pool, because inbreeding can become an issue. In terms of Auckland Zoo, the projects that we've got lined up for the next probably 10 years, we wouldn't need more space for. What we're going to be doing from here is we're busy doing this new veterinary centre, which I've mentioned. We're calling that the New Zealand Centre for Conservation Medicine. And by the way, that centre will have a whole public viewing gallery, so you'll actually be able to watch operations and diagnostic work on the go. So you'll be able to watch the vets in action all day, every day, provided obviously they're doing what's of interest. In terms of that space, the next focus is really on a New Zealand precinct area. And for those of you that know the zoo, the bottom end of the zoo, which runs from sort of where the otters are through to the big native walk-through aviary to what used to be the llama paddock, there's a large hillside of native fauna native flora across that area, and tree ferns. There's even nikau palms and a real kiwi feel to that whole bottom end of the zoo. So what we are going to be doing is, as that's the next project, is focusing on doing a New Zealand precinct right through that, which is a combination of fauna, flora and cultural. And when I say cultural, we're not talking about Maori dancing or anything like that. It's really an interpretation of what does the species, be it a plant or an animal, what does the species mean to the people of New Zealand, and what are some of the myths behind, for example, why does the saddleback have a red back? What does it mean if you hear Morpork calling? Or what is the flax plant used for? Or what was it used for by Maori? And it is still used for various items. So it's an interpretation, really, of our native fauna and flora from the Maori perspective. And a real immersion, must-see sort of experience. And this is going to be aimed at New Zealanders as well as foreigners. It isn't just about bringing in foreign tourists, because our own public, for example, if I was to say to Joe Bloggs, what's the difference between Kakariki, Kaka, Kokako, Kakapo and Kaki, how many people in New Zealand even know what half of those are? And these are all our native gems that really people should be exposed to. So we've got a lot of work to do on that side, and actually showing people what the native fauna really are, and also describing to them what the threats are to those species. So we have an appreciation not only for what is New Zealand, but what conservation measures need to take place to actually, safe for their safekeeping. So we won't need more space for that. And then thereafter, we'll be doing from where the orangutans are right up to where the tiger is at the moment, we're going to be developing a Southeast Asian precinct. And that will include red pandas, otters, tigers, the orangutans, and a lot more space for the orangutans, Siamang gibbons, probably Komodo dragons, which is a species in about 10 years that we would like to get involved with. And again, it's one of those mega reptiles with a tremendous story to be told, in terms of not only the fact that they can feed on goats and that sort of thing, which particularly with kids does excite them, but really what are the conservation issues around species such as the Komodo dragon, which are island species again. So that's probably going to take us into the next 10 to 15 years and many, many millions of dollars to be raised. And so we don't really need more space at the moment. It's more about renewing what we've got and making sure it's really a fantastic experience and the very best for the species that we've got. I don't believe we need more species. We do get some complaints. People come into the zoo and say, the tiger was sleeping, the lions were sleeping, I couldn't see the species, etc. It isn't any longer about a menagerie. So, for example, polar bears happened in the day of the postage stamp type collection, two of this, two of that, and the whole emphasis has changed to having species that need conservation measures, really, and also species in natural environments, which means larger enclosures, and it does mean you have to look that much harder. But we can't really nail down species just because we want better public viewing. We need to maintain, ethically, we need to maintain the best possible habitat we could to stimulate those species mentally, physically, the whole lot. So it's a very fine balance between public viewing and species. And yes, people, many people would like more species in the zoo. We personally would like a few more. There's species that we do want. For example, pygmy marmosets, which is the smallest monkey in the world that can fit in your hand. We've got 3 pairs at the moment waiting to come to us. They're sitting in Europe. And we've been working with MAF to get an import method for these species. And finally, we've got that. So we'll be having pygmy marmosets hopefully by middle of next year. But it takes a lot of work to bring a new species in. And rather than keep a whole lot of pet shop type common species, we really would like to stick to species with strong messages and species that need conservation measures. So space, overall, not an issue really. It's more about renewing. Capital projects these days for the zoo are expensive. Penguin sea lion shores cost in the region of $5 million. We opened that in 2001, and if we did it now, we know it would cost in the region of $10 million. The New Zealand precinct, I have no doubt, is going to cost between $12 and $15 million to do it really well. And I would rather wait to do it really well than to try and do a cheaper version, which will, again, not have the impact that we really needed to have. So it is expensive, and we look at about every 5 to 6 years now doing a major capital project such as that. By the time we've done the whole of New Zealand, we've done the Asian precinct, we're going to need to go back to Africa, because Africa will be over 20 years old by that stage, and we'll probably have to redo Africa. So we're aiming for a cycle of about 20 years of renewal of the entire zoo area, and the entire focus may change. For example, where the Kiwi House is at the moment, that will move to become part of the New Zealand precinct. And what we'd really like to do, and this isn't even in a funding stream at the moment, this is just on the wish list, but we'd love to build a big brand new aquarium there where people could actually come in the evening and dine while you're surrounded by these beautiful aquariums and enjoy that sort of experience as a function type centre. So we've got lots of plans. But again, in terms of the footprint, I think what is needed is for all zoos in New Zealand, probably an open range, more of a farm type area where we could have, you know, up to a dozen rhino, and you'd need a number of paddocks for that. But for Auckland Zoo itself, to be honest, we're fine.
Very good. Can I call back on the bears? You said bears. You're only meaning polar bears, or were you meaning also, say, big grizzlies and brown bears, but not sun bears? Or?
I meant all bears.
All bears.
Sun bears were on our collection plan for, I think it was about 8 years away, and we actually took them off the plan simply because of the challenges that you have. And to be honest, we've got so many other projects that we felt were more important. And just the challenges, you know, if we did build a bear exhibit, even if it was large, and we'd need to be careful because we do have limited space. So if you wanted to suddenly put in a very large bear enclosure, something else is going to have to go. And even then, some of the large bear enclosures, I've seen bears actually stand and sway and show that stereotypic type behavior, which wouldn't be acceptable to us.
Well, I'm really glad you're sensitive towards that. Yes, Glenn, important. And snakes and crocs, particularly large crocs. I mean, kids really like to see.
I grew up in South Africa with a bedroom full of weird and wonderful creatures, including a number of snakes. And as a conservation officer, I used an African rock python for education, and particularly with Zulu children. And there's a lot of myths about snakes amongst the Zulu people. They were petrified of snakes. But when you sit down quietly with a very tame python with a group of kids around you, and the kids actually get to touch the snake and it just very slowly moves, it's a phenomenal experience. It's something not to be forgotten. Now, the interesting thing in New Zealand is that it's actually gazetted by government that you may not have a snake, which, to be honest, is difficult to swallow from a zoo perspective. You can have a tiger, which could eat you, or a snake, which could perhaps bite you. And it really is, I don't know where that came from, but it is gazetted, it's law, you may not have a snake in New Zealand. We would love to, for example, bring in 3 pythons or boa constrictors, even if it was 3 males, so all the same sex. Have one at one of the zoos in the South Island, probably one in Wellington or one in Auckland, something on those lines, that Kiwi kids can actually get up close and meet a snake. Because there's so much people should learn about snakes, and they just... part of growing up, you know, kids have a fear of snakes. It's in books, it's everywhere, and to see some of the realities of snakes. I mean, they're phenomenal animals, but you can't experience it in New Zealand. So bit of a sore point, the snakes, but it's not something I'm going to be taking on. The zoo did try, I think it was about 10 years ago, to overcome that legislation and bring some snakes in for education. And I believe they even got hate mail. So definitely it's one of those things that perhaps you just don't go up against. Mm-hmm. But it is a pity, because all around the world they use snakes in education programs and they just work so well. But it's one of those things that's not meant to be. In terms of crocodiles, we've got alligators. There's a saltwater crocodile down at Napier Aquarium. There's only 3 alligators in New Zealand, and unfortunately the male doesn't get on with either of the 2 females. So there's been no breeding, and the species will be lost if we don't import. They're very popular amongst the public, even though alligators are actually quite small. Kids love Doris is our one alligator that we've got. And what we're working on at the moment is a reptile egg import health standard with MAF. So rather than bring in live animals, which can carry a number of diseases, if we limit it to eggs and we were just to bring in, say, a dozen alligator eggs, the disease issues are far less. And obviously we don't want to risk bringing in diseases that shouldn't be here. So if we bring in eggs, for example, there's about 5 diseases that you would need to look at, whereas if you bring in live animal, you're looking at about 30 diseases that you'd need to test for, and then there could be unknowns. So eggs are much safer, and hopefully in a couple of years we'll have some alligator hatchlings at the zoo.
Very good. And can we talk about your special, which is birds and birds' intelligence? Because one of the things was, I was just last week I was out up in the Coromandel and I was in a tent and I woke up to some bellbirds. And I can assure you, that sound passed right through my body. The dulcet tone just rang, vibrated all through me.
Well, they do. Bellbirds are fantastic. The best, to be honest, is to be in a forest early morning and hear kōkako. And I must mention, kōkako aren't pronounced kōkaku, because a lot of people pronounce the O with a kōkaku. It's kōkako, and they are just a phenomenal bird. It's a wattle bird. I can imitate the call, but it probably wouldn't work on radio. But the male does this phenomenal mournful call, and then the female answers early in the morning. Again, it's a territorial display. And the pair will sit together with their wings flitting, and they'll do this mournful calling to each other. And it's just fantastic. As you say, that sound goes right through you. And it's honestly, and I've done bird watching all over the world. Kōkako, the morning call, is that just fantastic. I don't think it's easy to beat.
And what about their intelligence?
Well, again, one of the species we've been working with, which is really interesting, I mentioned earlier that our staff spend a lot of time working with enrichment, so keeping animals busy, challenging them mentally and physically, because daily out in nature they get challenged. And the other thing, of course, with birds worldwide is birds are really a food source. People say as free as a bird, but birds are there to be eaten. They're a food source. Other birds eat them, cats eat them, snakes eat them, you know, etc. So they challenge daily just in terms of survival. And if you suddenly put a bird into an aviary and take away all challenges with a big bowl of food, well, it's going to become bored. And Kia are a really good example where in captivity, if you hold Kia and don't keep them enriched, you'll simply see a large green parrot sitting in the back of an aviary on a perch looking dull. The sad thing is about that, and I have seen that in some institutions, is that Kia are the most intelligent of the birds. And if you challenge them, they respond just like kids do to a challenge. They really, you know, rise to meet challenges. And we had an example where one of our staff started, she only worked with Kia every second Saturday, and she started doing a little training and conditioning program, which is about rewarding the behaviors that you want. And she thought, well, I'll try this, but most likely, because it's only 2 every 2 weeks, these birds aren't going to remember what it is I want them to do. So she started rewarding a few behaviors, even just the one bird jumping onto her hand, or she had a little perch connected to a scale, and if the bird jumped onto the perch, it would get a special food reward. And in no time, she realized that these birds were actually remembering everything she had taught them, and 2 weeks later performing exactly the behaviors that they had been through 2 weeks before. And so she grew this repertoire, and it became quite a regular, in fact now daily, occurrence, and they've got 30 different puzzles now that they give the Kia, and we just can't beat them, to be honest. We've come up with puzzles now that they have to pull pieces of string to move pieces of wood in a sliding panel to get hold of pieces of food, and they figure this stuff out in minutes. They're just absolutely phenomenal. And so the staff are placing these challenges in front of the birds. The birds are, you know, as I say, haven't been beaten yet. And the other thing that happens with it is that the staff bring the birds onto their hand, and they will say to the bird, for example, with a hand signal, they'll open two fingers on say, their right hand with the bird sitting on their left, and the opening of the fingers means that the bird should call. The bird then responds immediately and gives this loud kia call, which is a very harsh screech. The next thing that they do is they'll reward that, so they'll give the bird something special to eat. So anything special in the diet, for example, peanuts, which are really fattening, but the birds love them, you'll hold them back, so you won't put them in their tray of food. The only time they get peanuts is during that reward session, which is a lesson, by the way, for teenagers. And it works very well with human kids. Anyhow, the next behavior that they do is they ask the bird to actually open its wings. Now, kia have this amazing orange blaze under the wing. And instead of just being a dull green bird, they open their wings and there's this bright orange display. And the staff go through a number of these sorts of repertoires, and it just brings the bird to life. So throughout this time, not only are the public who are watching this getting a commentary and learning more about the bird and the bird's active, but the bird itself is challenged mentally and physically. And a lot of this is about mental challenge with the kia. And it is just unbelievable just how intelligent these birds are. And you don't even have to help them figure many of the puzzles out. You just leave them to it. And once they've done it once, they immediately are onto it, and they'll, you know, solve that puzzle within seconds every time. Another thing they do, for example, is they take a little camera spool canister, the little plastic canisters that your spool comes in, and they'll put that on a long string, and they'll put one peanut inside one of those with the lid on a long string, and they'll hang that from a perch, and the bird just immediately grabs the string, pulls it up, puts the piece of string under his foot, pulls it up again until it gets to the canister, opens the canister within seconds, takes his peanut, and then loses interest. These sorts of things, and you know, as I say, we haven't beaten them yet.
So he's not well mannered. He didn't put the lid on the canister.
No. They're quite destructive as well. Yeah. I remember hiring a vehicle once, and all the people were worried about was, please don't go near the kia because they strip everything off the vehicles, and they literally do that. And in every situation, I might mention there too, we have one person in the zoo who does browse. So all that person does 5 days a week is actually go around. We have a lot of contacts who contact us when they've got trees that have been chopped down, etc. But sometimes we'll actually go looking for plants and cut vegetation ourselves. And that person provides vegetation right around the zoo. So with kia, for example, it's more vegetation that the birds can just strip and ruin and make a mess. And that's part of their daily activity. With, for example, giraffe and Siamang gibbons, fresh leaves and browse is actually very much an essential part of the diet. So it's a really important role that this chap plays, just going out there day after day, bringing in browse, and then we get people bringing in trailer loads of bamboo as well. I might mention, if anybody's got any, please phone beforehand, because we sometimes get a little too much, but the elephants go through a lot of bamboo as well.
Very good, yes. I'd like to come back again to the news about New Caledonian crows in the wild routinely make up and use different tools to get food. I noticed there's one where a crow was reared in an Oxford laboratory, and it stunned a scientist there when with its command of Archimedean physics, when it picked up a length of wire, bent it into a hook, and started fishing out titbits from a tube. Yeah, so
I've actually watched, I'll just think of this example for a minute, but I remember sitting next to a pond that was full of fish in Africa. And that's right, they had fed the ducks, and there were duck pellets on the edge of the pond. And as the duck pellets sort of slowly filtered into the water, the fish were all gathered there and feeding on these duck pellets. And a sacred ibis, which is a sort of chicken-sized bird with a long bent bill, a sacred ibis actually walked up to the pellets, picked up a pellet, dropped it in the water, and of course all the fish rushed over, and the bird had a go at the fish, and I thought, oh, that was an off chance. And immediately, the bird missed the fish. Immediately, it went back and got another pellet and fished again. And actually put the pellet in the water and then actually grabbed the fish and ate it. And I watched the bird catch about three fish fishing with these duck pellets. So they learn very quickly. And birds like the corvids, the crow family, are highly intelligent. The most intelligent, I think, without a doubt, though, are the citizens, the parrot family. And so far from what I've seen, I think Kea ranked number one and probably African grey is number two.
Very good. So Kiwi's Kia's right up there.
Right up there.
Which, of course, our national bird spends most of its time in the dark. Very interesting. The whole animal kingdom, I think, is just great, and we should spend more time out there. And I think with what you've got at the zoo, you're setting a precedent. The microcosm seems to be taken care of in many ways. We're able to possibly take care of numerous bird species, but of course in the bigger picture, the global picture within the biosphere, that still is a challenge with deforestation, etc., or loss of habitat.
But it's amazing how many people in communities now are actually taking positive action. I've just been to Samoa, and we looked at what will become a Tiritiri type project. We looked at a small island where they're going to be doing a rat eradication. And I was on the island for a week with a number of the local community, and they're very keen to move ahead and see this happen. And they haven't even experienced it. You know, the likes of you and I have probably been to Turi and know what the fantastic benefits are of doing such a project. These people are just believing in it blindly, really, but they're just so keen to see something like this succeed for their native species. I was talking to somebody up at Tafanui. Now, Tafanui is a peninsula up near Warkworth, and they've put a predator-proof fence on the peninsula. And, again, the community have got right behind that and are involved in funding, fundraising, planting the native plants back in the area, in some cases even predator control. Ark in the Park up in the Waitakere's is another project with a lot of community support. And I believe Shakespeare Regional Park, the local community, have actually approached the regional council now saying we would like to achieve similar goals within Shakespeare. So a lot of people now are starting to make a difference, and you can make a difference. I think it's one of the questions that people wonder, you know, what difference can I make? And primarily it's about, as I mentioned earlier, what impact do I have on the environment? What impact do I have on the world? You know, am I leaving the light bulbs on? Am I leaving the tap running while I brush my teeth? Am I recycling, or like my teenage daughter, am I putting all my glass bottles in the bin and Dad then has to recycle them? You know, it's that type of thinking. And then, of course, linking to some of these projects. And in Auckland, we're so lucky. We've got a number of mainland projects. I've mentioned a few of them now. And we've got some of the offshore projects. I went out to Motuihe Island just recently. And again, the community had got in there with DOCT, working together, wiped out predators, finally got rid of rabbits. They've revegetated the island. And I went out for the first saddleback reintroduction, so we released 20 or so saddleback back onto that island. And that's something people, in terms of those who want to make a difference, there's so much in this Auckland region that you can get involved in as a volunteer, particularly. And I know a lot of people that go out weekends getting involved in these projects and get a tremendous sense of purpose from it.
Yes, volunteers. Can they volunteer to go to the zoo? I know there's all sorts of little ways you can put your hand up.
We rely on our volunteers a lot, and we've got a fantastic core. We've got about 120 people. In terms of involvement, it equates to about 13 full-time employees. So, you know, you can put in as much or as little as you want to. And we've got volunteers now who specialize. For example, some have got feely bags, and they walk around with these big bags with an ostrich egg and some orangutan hair and various artifacts, and they just stop people in the middle of the track and say, you know, have you ever touched an ostrich egg, or did you know orangutan's hair was this long? And kids love that sort of thing. It's very personal. A lot of the volunteers now conduct small tours for groups. And then, of course, there's some volunteers that do behavioral enrichment. So they'll do all of the frozen ice lollies for the kias and the orangutans and hidden food treats and that sort of thing. And then some just go out and, for example, get green kakuyu grass, which for our hippo and our springbok is a real treat. So we've got volunteers all over the zoo involved at various levels and doing a fantastic job.
And if any student wanted to take it further, and but it just had to go to university and do a
We actually run a course, a certificate in captive wild animals with Unitech. It's a collaborative course that we do. So you spend a certain amount of time in a zoo in New Zealand on the ground, one day a week over the year. And we take, I think it's 14 students that we do now per annum. And I think there's about 40 students doing it through New Zealand. So that's focused really a certificate in captive wild animals on the care of captive animals. You can, for example, many of our folks have done a BSc and then still gone on to do the certificate in captive wild animals as well. There's a number of such courses through Unitech, and as I say, we work in collaboration, particularly to provide that practical experience.
Do you bound out of bed every morning wanting to go to work? I mean, it must be so, I'd say, exciting, knowing that you're involved in the ARC process.
I think generally I do. I probably have the odd slow morning, particularly towards Friday. But it's very consuming. I personally am driven for real conservation goals. And the nice thing of being at the helm of this ship, if we can call it that, is to be able to steer it towards real conservation. And for many, for example, people who've worked with orangutans for 20 years, you know, I turned around a few years ago and said, look, you're doing nothing for conservation, just captive orangutans. We need to do more. And that's what we're driving and striving towards and striving to achieve. So I find it exciting to see the zoo moving more and more towards those goals.